We look forward to the study this evening to be presented by our brother Art, Old Testament Lives and Choices.
Good evening. And under that topic of Old Testament Lives and Choices, I've decided to choose this evening Jonathan. So when you would perhaps think about Jonathan, what are the first thing that comes to mind? And if you're anything like me, and some of you may be, probably the first thing that comes to my mind is his association with David, very close friendship they had, and his relationship with his father, Saul. Those are the two things that perhaps come, well, they don't perhaps, they came first to my mind in any case. And what I would like to do this evening is think a little bit more about it from a different perspective. Think about who Jonathan was as a person, not as compared to other people particularly. We'll certainly look at his interaction with both those people that I just mentioned, but thinking about him in his own right, so to speak. So, first of all, I just mention what his name means. Jonathan apparently means whom Jehovah gave. Now, as you probably know, I'm not one quick to associate character with names particularly. Sometimes there's some obvious ones in Scripture, and sometimes there isn't. And so I tend to be a little bit cautious on that, but I do have a couple suggestions that you might think reasonable towards the end, and we'll come back to that one. But that's what his name means, whom Jehovah gave, or whom God gave. Jonathan, there's approximately, I understand, about 15 different Jonathans or more, they say, mentioned in Scripture. The particular one, son of Saul, is obviously the most common of those. And the other thing that's interesting about this man, despite the fact he sees some prominence in the book of Samuel and a few notes in Chronicles, he's not mentioned in the New Testament. Whereas his father Saul, as being Saul, the son of Kish, is mentioned a couple of times. And, of course, David is mentioned many times, at least 54 in the New Testament. But it just gives us a little bit picture of how he's talked about in Scripture. There's a number of things we could say about his family. And in interest of time, I've reduced them to just a handful, just a couple of them. Things that bear relevance as we think a little bit more about this man. He's not just the son of Saul, he's the eldest son of Saul, which means that he's heir to the throne, which is an interesting position when you realize what he says in what's recorded for us. And obviously, as I mentioned earlier, he was a very close friend of David, but he was also David's brother-in-law, and sometimes we forget about some of those relationships. Not that you wouldn't have guessed it if I'd have asked you, but we don't think in those kind of terms. He was David's brother-in-law. And he had three brothers and two sisters, and we won't get into their names at this point because it's not particularly relevant to discussion this evening. But it appears, one thing that is interesting, that those three brothers and two sisters that he has appear to be from the same mother. It appears from what we were told that Saul had one wife and she was the mother of all his children. He has one son, Jonathan does, and that's Mephibosheth, or Jerubbaal as he's called elsewhere, same person. And when Jonathan dies, his son is only 5 years old. And we have that specifically mentioned in the record. So that's just a few things about Jonathan when it comes to perhaps vital statistics and things like that. What I would like to do is go through the chapters as they occur and pull a few things out of these chapters. So we first run across Jonathan in First Samuel chapter 13, and you might find it useful to flip through a few of these verses as we go. There's a lot of verses, and I'm not going to send you to all of them, and I'm not going to quote all of them, but as we go through, we'll be looking at a few of the events, and basically in the order they appear in the chapter. So, verse 1, it says, Saul was about, and NIV puts in, 30 years old when he became king, and he reigned over Israel 42 years. And those numbers are in a number of manuscripts, which is why they appear here. So it gives us a bit of an idea about Saul. And there could be a time gap between verse 1 and verse 2, because we're told that Saul chose 3,000 men from Israel, 2,000 were with him at Michmash in the hill country of Bethel, and 1,000 were with Jonathan at Gibeah in Benjamin. And I say the time gap because if he was 30 years old, then Jonathan was just a youngster and he wouldn't be in charge of 1,000 men. So it's thought at this time that Jonathan was probably in the neighborhood of 30 years old. So do the math. But the point is that this is how we are introduced to Jonathan without any pomp and ceremony, that he was in charge of 1,000 men at Michmash. We learn a little bit about Jonathan in verse 3 because it says he attacked the Philistine outpost at Gibeah. Now, as you know from what's happened during the latter part of the Judges and from the time of Samuel, the Philistines basically controlled Israel to a large extent, what they could and couldn't do. And we find out later that they didn't allow blacksmiths, and therefore there are no spears and there's no swords in the land because the Philistines had that kind of control over Israel. They were a stronger nation at this particular time, and they continued to be so. So Jonathan, with half the men Saul did, he chooses to take the incentive, or the initiative rather, and he attacks the Philistine outpost. Now that's kind of interesting when you look a little bit later down in verse 6, it says, when the men of Israel saw their situation was critical, and they realized in verse 5 that the Philistines had assembled to fight Israel because of this altercation, and they saw this massive amount, 3,000 chariots, 6,000 charioteers, soldiers as numerous as the sand on the seashore, a very common term in scripture to represent people as far as you could see. And it says in verse 6, the men of Israel saw their situation was critical and that their army was hard pressed, and they hid in the caves and the thickets among the rocks and the pits and the cisterns. They were hiding because they thought they were going to get overrun. And they were fleeing for their lives. And it says some of them crossed over into Jordan, to the land of Gad and Gilead. Now, do you think Jonathan knew that they were more numerous? Of course he did. Do you think he knew that they were better armed? Of course he did. Well, why did he do what he did? Was it a rash move? We'll leave that one for a moment and let you think about that. Why did he attack? It doesn't sound from the record like Saul told him to. It looked like he arbitrarily did. But one thing that is interesting about the attack is in verse 3 it says, then Saul had the trumpet blown throughout the land and said, let the Hebrews hear, so all Israel heard the news. Saul has attacked the Philistine outpost, and now Israel has become a stench to the Philistines. All the people were summoned to join Saul at Gilgal. It says, Saul attacked the outpost, and you might say, well, he didn't really, but it's the royal we kind of a thing, and when someone in Israel attacks, it's as if Saul is, because he's in charge of the army, and that very well may be, but as you learn a little bit more about Saul, the latter is more likely that he was taking the achievement himself rather than Jonathan, and I think that's clear, at least in later events, perhaps not here. Maybe we're taking a little bit off Saul, but I don't think it's unjustified when we see how he looks at other situations a little bit later. But in any case, we'll leave that for the time being and go into chapter 14 with this in mind, what he's just done. You remember, all Israel is very, very scared because of this huge army that is amassed against them. And it says in chapter 14, verse 1, one day Saul, or Jonathan, son of Saul, said to the young man bearing his armor, come, let us go over to the Philistine outpost on the other side. But he did not tell his father. Now, why didn't he tell his father? Well, it could have been a number of things. Perhaps he wasn't looking for a no answer. Perhaps he thought this was a good thing to do, and he didn't want his father knowing about it. Not only did his father not know, nobody knew except his armor bearer, whom he spoke to. And you probably remember the account when he decides that he's going to attack. And it talks about the situation where on each side of a pass that in verse 4 that Jonathan intended to cross to reach the Philistine outpost was a cliff. And Jonathan says in verse 6 to his young armor bearer, come, let's go over to the outpost of those uncircumcised fellows. Perhaps the Lord will act on our behalf. Nothing can hinder the Lord from saving, whether by many or by few. So he wasn't deterred with the amassing of troops. Why? Why? The same question we had earlier. Why did he attack when the people were very much afraid and hiding and running for their lives? And was he being rash in what he was doing? Why did he attack when everyone else was afraid to? Well, part of it is in that verse 6, I think. When it says, let's go over to the outpost of those uncircumcised fellows. I don't think that was just a derogatory term for the Philistines. When we find out the type of person that Jonathan was, I would suggest that what he's doing is referring to the fact that these people are outside the covenants of promise, outside the covenant that God made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. That God gave them this land. It was the inheritance. It was the promised land. And these people, and the uncircumcised part, is outside of the covenant, I think. And these people are not there by right. They are on God's land that he chose to give to his people, Israel. And they had no right to be there. I think that's the implication there. And when you look at what he says, he doesn't say, we're going to go and do this. He says, nothing can hinder the Lord from saving, whether by many or by few. He doesn't say, we'll do this, although that's what they do. He says, nothing can hinder the Lord from saving. And he's not doing it rashly, because when the armor bearer says, do everything you have in mind, I'm with you heart and soul, which is quite a dedication when you look at the odds, two men against an outpost. They're way up there. They can easily defend on people coming up the hill. Jonathan, he does something interesting. He says in verse 8, come then, we'll cross over towards the men and let them see us. And if they say to us, wait here and we'll come down to you, we'll stay where we are and we won't go up to them. But if they say, come up to us, we will climb up, because that will be our sign that the Lord has given them into our hands. So he's not, as we might say, going ahead blindly. It's not rash. Is he brave? Of course he's brave. But he's saying this will be the sign that the Lord will deliver them into our hands. So what we have here is in keeping with what we find out about him later, that when he believes that he's acting in accordance with God's will, he is strong. But he's strong not because he's simply brave, but because of the faith that he has. He's brave as well, but it's the faith that drives him. It's the faith that says, yes, we will do this because the Lord will deliver. And it echoes of many people. It echoes of Gideon just a little bit earlier, who with 300 men went and attacked hordes of people because God said, you will do this for me. And he asked for a sign similar to Jonathan, and he received a sign. He received two of them, and God delivered those hordes into his hand, and he knew what that power was. He was convinced at an early age, As heir to the throne, he took this chance, as some would see it, because he had this faith that was able to carry him. It's like Moses standing at the edge of the Red Sea and the Egyptian armies coming down upon the people that he had taken out of the land, and he says, "Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord." And the waters are parted by God's hand. And there are so many others that are like that. Elijah on Mount Carmel with the prophets of Baal and soaking wet sacrifice, and he calls upon God to bring fire down, consume the sacrifice. There's so many other examples like this, and Jonathan fits right into it. The Lord has given them into our hands. So it reminds me of the verse in Hebrews where I think Jonathan belongs. In Hebrews 11, when it's in 33 and 34, it talks about who through faith conquered kingdoms, became powerful in battle, and routed foreign armies. And this wasn't the first time. It continued to happen. And that's the kind of person Jonathan was. Through faith, did these things. And I think that's how, certainly how I see him anyway. The other thing that's interesting, when they do go up, he and the armor bearer, Jonathan doesn't send him forward first like cannon fodder. Jonathan goes first and climbs up, and his armor bearer is right behind him in verse 13. And it's interesting, even when he starts slaying the enemy, it says in the first attack, Jonathan and his armor bearer killed some 20 men, but it says that verse 13, Jonathan using his hands and feet, climbed up with his armor bearer right behind him, and the Philistines fell before Jonathan, and his armor bearer followed and killed behind him. So he took the lead in this. He took the responsibility, and he believed that God was with him, and because he did this, he was. And I would just like to pause for a slight digression. I have three little digressions, but I think this is where we have to stop and think for a moment, because this is what it says to me. We all would admit that God, if he so chooses to, can do absolutely anything. We know that. Sometimes we have trouble believing that ourselves in some situations, sometimes. But we know that to be true. And in moments when we're thinking rationally about Scripture and we think of examples, we know that to be true. On this occasion, God didn't say to Jonathan, "I want you to go up and attack the Philistines, you and your armor bearer." God didn't tell him to do that. God waited for him to act in faith. And when he acted in faith, God blessed that faith with success, actually miraculous success when you look at the odds. Two men against many. And I just wonder sometimes whether that's the case with us. Whether sometimes God is waiting for us to demonstrate our faith. And I'm not thinking in a manner so drastic as this, when we're being asked to deal with a huge amount of people when the odds seem impossible to human thought. I'm just thinking about sometimes I wonder if God is waiting for us to act in our lives in faith. And when we do act in faith, he blesses us also. I think that is the case. And it just reminds me of how many times I perhaps haven't done that. I've just continued through the life that I have in front of me. I have certain things that I do. And sometimes we need to think afresh about standing up in faith and doing things, confident that God will bless us. It's like when Jesus says, "Ask and you shall receive," believing that you ask, receive, believe that you will receive, and comments like that. And sometimes I think the power of that we can forget about. Not that we do, but that we can do. So Jonathan took the initiative in this one, and God blessed him for it, and I think that's just something to think about. So that's the digression. But what's interesting about this one, and the reason I brought that one up specifically, is not only for that digression, but also because it sets the scene for something else. And that something else is when the enemy is set in array and some of them are fighting against each other, and Saul sees this and hears about it, and he says, well, what's going on? And he capitalizes on what's going on, and he and his army come out and they chase the Philistines. And essentially what Jonathan started wound up in a huge defeat of the Philistines at Israel's hands. But during the course of that time, you will remember the record, I believe, when Saul said, no one will eat anything until we have defeated the enemy, and made that vow. And Jonathan, not having heard that vow because he wasn't there when the time, was very, very hungry. He was a bit weak from all the energy he had exerted, and he ate some honey, and you remember the account. And then when Saul tries to determine who it was that broke this vow, finds out that it's Jonathan. And I'm skipping a lot of detail because I want to hone in on a couple of things. And we find that in chapter 14. And at the end, Saul picks out Jonathan and he says, what have you done? In chapter 14, verse 43, and Jonathan says, I merely tasted a little honey at the end of my staff, and must I die? And look at Saul's reaction in verse 44. May God deal with me, be it ever so severely, if you don't die, Jonathan. Now, two things. I guess this is more about Saul, but when he first came to be king, there were those who would say, shall Saul reign over us? And when Saul exhibited kingly tendencies, those who supported him said, let's drag out those people who said, shall Saul reign over us, and let's kill them. And you know what Saul said on that occasion? Saul said, for this day, no one shall die this day. That's what he said. Nobody is going to die today. Why? For this day, the Lord has rescued Israel. It was a previous defeat of the enemy. And he says, for this day, the Lord has rescued Israel. So nobody's going to die. We're not going to be killing each other here. This is a day to rejoice because God has blessed us. That's what he said previously. But when Jonathan did this and wrought a great victory in Israel by the hand of God, but through Jonathan, what does he say? He says, you're going to die. You're going to die. The heir to the throne, his son, he says, you're going to die. And what happens next is very interesting, because it's the soldiers who come and confront their king. They confront their king on Jonathan's behalf at this point. And they say, should Jonathan die, he who has brought about this great deliverance in Israel? Never. That's how the NIV puts it. As surely as the Lord lives, they said, not a hair of his head will fall to the ground. For what he did today, he did with God's help. They identify what Jonathan did as being with God's help. And I find that interesting. I think it says a little bit about Jonathan and how the people perceived Jonathan, and that they perceived Jonathan differently than they perceived their king Saul. So that is a telling change in the character of Jonathan's dad, Saul, in the way he behaved. But it's also telling in the way the men stood up to the king, because that was a dangerous thing for them to do. It's the equivalent of mutiny. He said, you're going to die. And they said, no, he's not. And this is a king. You don't do that. And as you find out later, Saul wasn't short of doing anything. He had priests killed because they had helped David. Nothing was beyond him. He could have had some of his head officers killed right there. But they stood up because of what God had wrought through Jonathan as they saw it. And I think that is very interesting. And the other thing that's interesting is in chapter 14, verse 29, is Jonathan's summation of his father's reign. And he hadn't reigned that long at this time. At least it doesn't appear that he reigned too long. It says in verse 29, if I can find it, little print. Jonathan said, my father has made trouble for the country. And this is after he was told, oh, by the way, your dad said, cursed is anyone who eats food today. And he said, my father has troubled the country. He doesn't just deal with the issue of, well, that was a stupid thing to say. It's whitewash. He's troubled the country. So we know what Jonathan thinks, and we see the two of them parting choices very early. Parting, you know what I mean. The relationship that we see between Jonathan and his dad, Saul, at this point, is starting to get a little bit difficult, but nothing like it's going to get a little later. The choices that Jonathan is about to make in the next few chapters, as we have it in our Bibles, is going to define who Jonathan is as an individual. And it makes his life difficult. It makes it complicated. And a lot of these things are quite consequential in terms of how his father reacts. So his dad's choices do get worse. And we remember the part where he disobeyed the Lord in terms of what he had told them about what they were to do when they fought against Agag. And it was just after that that Samuel comes to him and says, what is this bleating of sheep that I hear? Why did you do this? Why did you disobey the Lord? And Saul makes excuses and basically tells half-truths and perhaps lies. And he stumbles along and he's continually losing respect. So here you are, Jonathan, heir to the throne, and this is your dad. And it's great when your dad's number one in the country. He's the king, but it's another thing altogether when the things that he does is not only wrong sometimes, but more and more it's becoming clear that he is not serving the Lord the way he should serve the Lord. And that's what Jonathan is judging by. It's not by popular poll of the people. It's not like the elections now. He's judging by things that are right and wrong, but right and wrong before the Lord. So it's very hard to honor your dad when he's making those kind of decisions. It becomes a bit of an embarrassment, I would suggest. And it is just after this that Samuel said to Saul, well, God has rent the kingdom from you, and he's going to give it to somebody who he has chosen, someone after his own heart. And then we have David coming on the scene in chapter 15 is the one where God rejects Saul from being king. And then we have chapter 16 where where Samuel anoints David as king. And we won't spend too much time on David because David is not the person we are dealing specifically with this evening, although he certainly enters into it. But the thing of interest in terms of what we're thinking about tonight is when David comes into Saul's palace and he's entered into Saul's service, which starts in verse 14. It says that Saul had this evil spirit that came upon him, and basically Saul said to one of his servants, he says, go and find me somebody who can play the harp well to soothe me, etc. And so the servant comes back in verse 18. That's where Saul, 17 is where Saul sends him. And he says, bring to me. And then verse 18, one of the servants answered, I have seen the son of Jesse of Bethlehem. And before I read the next few words, he gives the credentials of David, and he basically says five things. The first four things, well, they have to do with the job, qualifications for the job. But the fifth thing is gratuitous. He's thrown it in, and it's his own assessment of who David is. He says, first of all, I've seen the son of Jesse who, number one, knows how to play the harp. Number one credential, because if he didn't do that, it wouldn't fulfill what Saul had asked for. But he also says he's a brave man and a warrior, number two. In other words, he's not a disgrace. If you had this man here, he's an upstanding citizen in this country. So you wouldn't be pulling in somebody who could possibly disgrace you. Number three, he speaks well. That's a good thing for someone who's going to be in the palace. And he's a fine-looking young man, so he will fit in that way as well. But then he says, and the Lord is with him. Now that's interesting, because whether the Lord is with him or not, the credential Saul wanted was someone to play the harp. He didn't have to have that. But this man had observed that. He knew something about David. He knew something about David. And the reason I underline that is because it's not unreasonable to assume that if this man knew that, a number of other people knew that. And that he's not the only one to notice. And it also says that David had established himself fairly young in his life as being somebody whom the Lord was with. And that's interesting. And why note that? Well, because in chapter 16, verse 21, it says Saul liked him. He liked him very much. And David became one of his armor bearers, which I suppose is an honor. Then we have the account of the killing of Goliath by David. Now, there's a question here whether David and Goliath incident came before he was pulled into Saul's service. And there's good reason one way or another, and I'm not going to get into that one tonight, but that's an interesting one. But whichever way around it happened, what's interesting is after we go through this description of David and Goliath, the next thing that we hear in chapter 18, it says, end of 17 says, and David said, I am the son of your servant Jesse of Bethlehem. And Saul asked him who he was. The next verse, chapter 18, verse 1, and after David had finished talking with Saul, Jonathan became one in spirit with David and he loved him as himself. Now that doesn't happen overnight. And I would suggest to you that he knew who David was too, just like that servant of Saul. And whatever time there was that passed there, the reason that he had this bond with David isn't because he thought he was a swell guy. It was because of where his priorities was, where the heart of this man was. And that adds credence to say that's where Jonathan's heart was too. That's where that bond is. That bond couldn't have been that strong if that hadn't been the founding principle. So, that's where we have this friendship first talked about. And it says, I believe, a lot about who Jonathan was, that he chose this particular person. Now, there is further development in the family of Jonathan that occurs upon David's success. Because as you continue on through chapter 18, it says, this is where they wrought a great victory, and the people saying, you know, Saul has killed his thousands and David his tens of thousands. And when that happens, Saul, it says, became, in verse 8 and 9, angry. And it says he became jealous. Those are the words the NIV uses, probably very similar in the King James. And then we're told he was so jealous that, verse 11, it says, end of verse 10, he was prophesying in his house while David was playing the harp as he usually did. Saul had a spear in his hand and he hurled it, saying to himself, I'll pin David to the wall. I'll kill him. David eludes him. But it's interesting what it says after that. Saul was afraid of David. And what's interesting is how everybody else perceived him. That's how Saul perceived him. But everybody else, it says in verse 16, that Israel, all Israel loved David. The dynamics, and this is the point, are changing in the house of Saul. And the dynamics are changing for Jonathan as a result of these things. Jonathan was that close, close friend of David. And the dynamics had all of a sudden taken a severe change. and it was inevitable. And that brings us into chapter 19. Chapter 19 is what we just read a few verses of, and it's quite telling what happens here. Quite telling indeed. This is where things really start to change, the relationship Jonathan has with his dad. And it's where he puts his convictions to the test. And Saul commands Jonathan and his attendants to kill David, verse 1. And the first thing Jonathan does, he has this bond with David, remember? What's the first thing he does? Well, he goes out and warns David. And then he doesn't just leave it at that. What does he do next? Well, the next thing he does is he confronts his dad. Now, that's rather a foolish thing to do if you were looking at it from a human perspective. But he challenges his dad and he says, why? What evil has he done? Let not the king do this wrong to his servant David. He hasn't wronged you, verse 4. And everything he's done has benefited you greatly. He took his life into his hands when he killed the Philistine. And the Lord, he says, won a great victory over all Israel. He's trying to support David. And what does he say? The Lord wrought the great victory over Israel. Again, every word here is very telling. And he says, you saw it and were glad. Remember that. And he said, why then would you do wrong to an innocent man like David in killing him? And Saul listens to Jonathan. That's interesting. One of the few times, probably the only time, that we have on record. And Saul says, as surely as the Lord lives, David will not be put to death. So he basically swears to Jonathan that won't happen. What's interesting here is when Jonathan puts his courage and his faith out there first, just like before, what happens? God blesses him. He blesses him for it. Because number one, Saul doesn't kill him, nor does he even punish him. And number two, what we have is that he gets his dad to temporarily change his mind. So that is interesting. The other thing that we find as we move through the chapter is Michael. And I had a few things to say on this, but again, in the interest of time, I'm going to cut this a little bit short. Michael is a part of the dynamic, and it's a dynamic that couldn't help but affect Jonathan as well. But what happens in the chapter is that Michael knows that her dad is trying to kill David, and she aids David and helps him escape. You remember the scenario. So she's in a predicament as well in the family dynamic. My dad wants to kill him. My brother has a very close relationship with him that is founded on a higher calling. I may lose my husband. He may either be killed or he may have to run away from my dad. I have no children. And that was a very, very large thing, as you know, in biblical times. And as I said before, Jonathan was not immune to these kind of things going on. It would have hurt him as well. And David now is on the run. He had to run, and she had helped him start that run. And what does David do after he's sent on the run this time? He comes back to the one he can count on. He comes back to Jonathan. He says, Jonathan, what have I done that your dad is trying to kill me? In chapter 20, verse 1, what have I done? And Jonathan says, it isn't so. My dad wouldn't do anything without telling me first. And David said, well, you misunderstand, I think, Jonathan. I think he knows of our relationship, and he purposely didn't tell you this. And Jonathan isn't so sure. But David at this point is more perceptive than Jonathan when it comes to Saul. And David assures him, and in the third verse he says, there is only a step between me and death. Only a step between me and death. And then I think we have in verse 4 what I would call a hallmark Jonathan statement. He doesn't argue the point anymore with David. He doesn't try to change his mind. He says, whatever you want me to do, I'll do it for you. Whatever you want me to do, I'll do it for you. And that's an amazing statement. It's very significant. Because not only does that reaffirm that their friendship is stronger and greater than bloodlines. But it's also a friendship through faith. It's also something that he's taken to a higher level. And when you go a little bit further in the chapter, you find in verse 15 that he makes a covenant. The two of them make a covenant. And they're two great friends, and they're feeling tremendous pressures on both of them. And the pressures they're feeling are going to come to bear, because the choices they make are potentially choices that are a matter of life and death. In both cases. In both cases. And what they say is they're aligning themselves with each other. But verse 15 is particularly... No, that's not the one I'm looking for. 20... That's part of the covenant in 14 and 15. They talk about their promise to each other. But show me in verse 14, unfailing kindness like that of the Lord, as long as I live, that I may not be killed. And do not cut off your kindness from my family, not even when the Lord has cut off every one of David's enemies from the face of the earth. And who's David's enemy? David's enemy is Saul at this time, because he's wanting to kill David. And what does Jonathan say? He made a covenant with David saying, may the Lord call David's enemies to account. Now that's interesting, because that's a fair statement. But neither David nor Jonathan say, may Saul die. Neither of them lift a hand against Saul specifically. They don't do that because they are of a higher calling. And David proves that on a couple of occasions, as we probably remember. And Jonathan here simply says, may they be called to account. What does that mean? What does that mean? Well, what it means is that they're leaving it in God's hands. It's not in their hands. They're admitting that. They're leaving it for God to look after. May they be called to account before God, not before them. They left everything in God's hands. Verse 18, Jonathan goes on to say that in the matter about which you and I discussed, remember, the Lord is witness between you and me forever. And it's that that is their bond again. It's reaffirmed. And we then go through the account where David is supposed to be at a banquet, and he's fear for his life, so he doesn't go. And Jonathan says, well, look, I'll determine whether he really is trying to kill you. And then it's quite significant in that when you come down into chapter 20, verse 31, Saul is very, very angry with Jonathan, because he can tell Jonathan's trying to defend David. And he says in verse 30, don't I know that you have sided with the son of Jesse to your own shame and the shame of the mother who bore you? Verse 31, don't you understand, Jonathan, that as long as the son of Jesse lives on the earth, neither you or your kingdom will be established? Bring him to me. He must die. And then Jonathan says it again, second time. Why should he be put to death? What has he done? But this time, for the second time, Saul tries to kill Jonathan. He hurls a spear at him. Remember, it wasn't beyond him. He wanted to kill him when he had eaten the honey. This time, he throws a spear at him. Jonathan knew that he had determined in his mind to kill David. Now, what's interesting is the character of this man. It says he got up from the table in fierce anger. But what did Jonathan do with his anger? You know, saw what Saul did with his anger. He picked up a spear and chucked it at him. He did the same with David. He often acted out of anger and fear. Jonathan was very angry. Of course he was angry. What was the second emotion that came across Jonathan's mind? Well, it's interesting. First thing he did, he got himself up and removed himself from the situation. He didn't even say anything. He didn't throw a spear back at Saul. He didn't say anything that would escalate this problem. He removed himself from that particular problem. And what was the emotion that he showed? It said he was grieved. He was grieved at his father's shameful treatment of David. He's a different man from his father. That's very, very clear. Everything we read about him shows he's a different man from his father. He had some similarities in that he was he's a strong warrior. He could do all kinds of physical things. But that's about where the similarities ended. So now, the trust that they had, the bond they had, the covenants they had were in essential mode because they knew what Saul was about to do. And Saul chases David. He hunts him down. And everything that Jonathan says in the record is important. When you read what he says and what he chooses not to say and what he chooses not to do, you see the stature of the man. And every time that we see them, it's confirmed once more in chapter 20 and verse 42, after they meet together, after Jonathan comes to him and said, yes, my dad's going to kill you. He almost killed me. Jonathan says to David in 42, go in peace, for we have sworn friendship with each other in the name of the Lord. Now, isn't that a peculiar thing to say? Saul is trying to kill David, and he just tried to kill Jonathan. And Jonathan says, go in peace? Well, it's a different plane of thought that he's talking about, isn't it? He says, for we have sworn our friendship with each other before the Lord and in our descendants forever. In other words, what more can we do? We have done what we can. And again, we've placed it in the Lord's hands. It's not peace in their lives he's talking about. It's the peace that God extends to them. It's the peace of knowing that God is in control and that if they trust in him, no matter what's happening, God knows and will give them the strength to face whatever it is that's before him. That's the peace we're talking about. And it's a testimony to this man's character. Chapter 23 is an interesting one also. Because David's running for his life. And remember, just before chapter 23 is when Saul has had all the priests but one killed. The priests of the Lord. He stops at nothing with his anger, again, lashing out not so much at the priest per se, although that's where he took it out on. It was his anger with David. Sure, they helped him in his mind, but it was David that he was so angry about. It was David that caused him to do this. And David took that really heavily when he found out what Saul did. He says, I am responsible, was the words that David used. He felt bad about this, and David was on the run. He knew what Saul would stop at nothing. He knew from what we were told in this chapter, very, very clearly, God says, look, you stay in that city, those people will hand you over to Saul to be killed. They will do that rather than die themselves because they know what he did to the priests, and they'll kill you too if you don't hand him over. And so David knows he has to run from there. But he's been running for a little while. So we get to 23, and we come across something that's interesting. Actually, in verse 14 of 23, David stayed in the desert in strongholds in the hills, and he was running. Day after day, Saul searched for him, but God did not give David into his hands. Again, God is protecting him. Then we come across something that is, I think, very, very interesting. It says in 15, David was at Horesh in the desert of Ziph, and he learned that Saul had come out to take his life. Well, why does it say that? He knows Saul's come to take his life. He'd been chasing him around the country. Why does it say he knew Saul had come to take his life? He knew that a lot earlier. He had been running from him. He had seen what he did to the priests. He knew what God told me he'd do to the people in Keilah, or whatever it was. Why did he say this? I think we are being told something about David at this point, and it's what we see in the next few verses. When he knew that he had come out to take his life, we read something that I think is the most telling verse in Scripture about Jonathan. Verse 16, "And Saul's son Jonathan went to David at Horesh and helped him find strength in God." And all I can say is, wow. The man after God's own heart, the man who poured out his life for every one of us in the Psalms, who we can read about, and we can identify with, whose emotions we see, that man who was so close to God was strengthened by Jonathan. The other thing about this that's interesting, Saul was looking all over the country for him. Jonathan knew where he was. Didn't know about where he was. He knew exactly where he was. He knew where to find him. That took a concerted effort on Jonathan's part. It took concern and a concerted effort on Jonathan's part, which says an awful lot about Jonathan and the importance, the priority put on David. So he goes to his friend. And I think this is digression number two. I think we all can think of people in Scripture, faithful men and women in Scripture, who have lived absolutely exemplary lives from our perspective. We think, if I only had half the faith. I think we have had that kind of a thought in our minds at times. But we can read about some of these people who, at some points in their life, are made to feel very, very weak. Regardless of how strong they may have been, there are times when they are prone to exhaustion with the life around them that they almost want to give up. Elijah was like that. He said to God, "Take my life. You know, I'm ready to die. Just take my life." A man who was very strong in the Lord. There are times when people feel distressed and down. And I can't help but think that God knew that that was the point that David was at right here. And God knew what to do. Of course, he knows everything. Now, God had done other things in David's life. When Saul was chasing him, he protected David. Protected all the way along. And as David said when he came to Saul, "Well, the Lord saved me from the bear, from the lion, and he can save me from Goliath." And he did save him from Goliath. David knew that. This is the power of the man from the youth right through to now. But this time, he was down. And God could have performed a miracle at that point and sent Saul after in another direction, or had someone attack Saul and Saul might have to stop chasing David. He could have intervened. But this time, he chose not to. He chose to help David, but he did it by using people. And he often does. He chose Jonathan to go and fix it, basically. He sent Jonathan. And it just underlines that God uses people. He uses you and he uses me. And sometimes we are the vehicle by which others that he loves are helped. Sometimes that's how God operates. And it makes me think how important it is to have the association we do with one another. How important it is to know a bit about each other and to inquire about each other and to help each other. And again, I look at myself and think, I don't do enough of that. Because who's to know when God will choose us to help somebody else? And he doesn't take somebody who doesn't want to do it and make them do it. He takes somebody who wants to do that anyway, who is trying to serve him. And those are the people he uses to help those he loves, usually. So it's something to think about. This time, God sent Jonathan. And that says more about Jonathan, I think, than anything else in Scripture, because that's the stature of that man. That's who he was, and it's who he became through all the trials he had. And he goes on to say in verse 17, "Don't be afraid. My father Saul will not lay a hand on you. You will be king over Israel." Why did he say that? Was he trying to patronize him and say, "Oh, it's okay, don't worry. No. He knew that Samuel had anointed him. I'm convinced of that. And when God said, "You're going to be the king over Israel," Jonathan believed it. That's why he says to David, "You're going to be king," because he believes in God, and that's what God says. "And I will be second to you. There's no contest here. He's saying, look, I don't even want to be king. I want you to be king because it's God's choice, and I want God's choice. And that's the prevailing thing in Jonathan's life. And then Jonathan went home, it said. So that's interesting also. So just to begin to wrap up here, I have three more things basically to say. The first one is, we're looking today at Jonathan for who he was, what kind of man he was, and how he operated, and what choices he made, the life that he lived, the commitment that he had. And the umbrella I chose of old lives, Old Testament lives and choices, is one that I chose for a topic because when we read, I've done a couple of them so far, but when we read about people like this, whether it be the one did last time, Saul, which was a rather negative one in some respects, but it had positive application as well, or Jonathan, which is a very positive one, they're all things that if we think about them and think about them on a personal level, not just when we're here, when we go home and mull it over and mull it over when we do the readings, really those things should be enough to influence us in our own lives, in the decisions we make, in the lives that we live. And they're there for us. It's about our commitment to Christ as well. And we learn from the lives of others. It's the choices that we make and the basis on which we're making those choices in a consistent manner. It's who we choose to place our trust in on a consistent basis. It's those kind of things that make this kind of person and so many others in Scripture so important to us, because if they have no effect on us, then we're really missing out. We're not growing the way we should be growing. We need to grow, and we need these people to think about, and we need to put ourselves in some of these situations. Which brings me to the second of the three things, which is digression number three, and that is the relationship that we see with Jonathan and David is a relationship we need to think about as well in terms of our own relationships, our own friends, our own choices in that regard. This man supplied spiritual strength to David, the man after God's own heart. And there is no greater friend to a follower of Christ than someone who can, when it's, particularly when it's really needed, can supply that spiritual strength. There's nothing greater than someone who acknowledges God above themselves and has you as a friend, and you have them as a friend, who chooses to put self second or perhaps even third in some cases because of their commitment to God, who encourages the others, not just with the logic of the situation, although sometimes that lends a great deal of help as well, but also helps you to find strength in God, who puts their arm around you, whether literally or figuratively, and said, this is what we have to do. This is the hope we have. This is where we put our life. This is where we put our trust, and encourages in that direction. There is no greater friend than a friend like that. Strong in faith, accepting what God has determined above everything else. That's what Jonathan did. The kingship, God had determined David. He was happy with that. He was completely okay with that. So that's the other digression, is the treasure of friends who can help us find strength in God. So tying it up, if we go back to one of the comments I started with, Jonathan, whose name apparently means whom Jehovah gave, could it possibly, and I'll put it that way, could it possibly have some relevance when we consider just the few things we've thought about this evening, where we've been brought to now, that this is a man God loved, and God gave his name, God gave this man to his nation in a time when he was badly needed. God gave this man to someone that he made a covenant of promise with, to David, to be that friend, to be that bulwark that he needed through a very, very important part of his life. That God gave this man, Jonathan, for every one of us who, a few thousand years later, can read and see the value in the friendships in which we have. In the stature of a man who said, if this is God's will, I'm doing it. I'm going up to that garrison up there because I know that God has answered me and he says, do it. I don't care if there's 35, 50, 172 people up there and we're only two. I know and I'm convinced and I'm acting upon it because God says. That's the man that he gave for every one of us to remember. And that's who Jonathan was, a man who made hard choices, very hard choices, and he made them for God. And he put God first. He was bold to act, but bold because he was faithful, not because he was rash. And who had a spiritual strength, aside from David, a spiritual strength that was in contrast to the lack of which his father, to which his father had a lack of when he, in his end, lay out after receiving the words from the witch of Endor, and he was too weak to move. That was the end of his father. Jonathan was almost the polar opposite of that. Jonathan was a man who lived God's way, placing his decisions and, in essence, his life in the hands of God.